This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I'm going to start today's show with a scene from the 1944 classic film noir, Double Indemnity.
Yes, I killed him. I killed him for money. And for a woman. And I didn't get the money and I didn't get the woman.
Yeah, that's how a lot of men in film noir end up. They don't get the money and they don't get the woman. What they do often get is double-crossed and killed. Double Indemnity is one of the films we're going to talk about today with Eddie Muller, who you may know as the host of the Turner Classic Movie Show, Noir Alley, where each Saturday night he screens a film noir. Even if you don't have time to watch the film, his intros are worth tuning in for. Muller has impeccable noir credentials. His book, Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir, was just published in a new expanded edition. He's the author of a book about the women who starred in these films. He's the founder and president of the Film Noir Foundation, which has restored and preserved more than 30 nearly lost classics in partnership with the UCLA Film and Television Archive. Some of the great film noirs were set in the world of boxing, a world Muller was well acquainted with through his father, also named Eddie Muller, who was considered the West Coast dean of boxing writers and covered boxing for the San Francisco Examiner for over 50 years. He covered his first prize fight in 1926. I interviewed Eddie Muller once before, today's Eddie Muller, not his father, and that was in 1996, after the publication of his book Grindhouse, The Forbidden World of Adults-Only Cinema. Eddie Muller, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is such a treat to have you back on the show.
I am so happy to be here, Terry.
So let's talk about what you mean when you say film noir.
Well, yes, this is one of the reasons it remains so fresh is because it's debatable. Everybody gets to argue about what it is, which really isn't the case with Westerns or musicals or anything. So that's a big part of the appeal, I think. But for me, when I refer to film noir, I'm talking about an organic artistic movement that took place mostly in Hollywood in the mid-20th century. And there's a lot of factors that, go into making something a film noir. They're generally crime stories, and they present a very dark vision of existence, let's say.
How dark? More, please.
I also consider film noir to be sort of the anti-myth. If what Hollywood was always selling was that everything's going to be all right and we're all going to live happily ever after, film noir was the flip side of that coin, saying you really can't trust anybody. The system does not really work for you particularly. You may have to steal to get what you want, just like Fred McMurray says at the top. You know, he wanted that woman and he's going to get the money and he's going to do it through devious means. And these things rarely work out. But man, it sure is fun watching people fail.
And as you've pointed out, most film noir combines like the sinister and the sensual.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons the films remain so popular is because they're very sexy in a way that films aren't sexy today because they were made, you know, during the existence of the production code. And that required a certain amount of restraint by the artists making these films, which is, I think, one of the great pleasures of the movies is how the artists worked around the code and could be suggestive and therefore very sensual when they're making these pictures.
Well, let's hear another clip. And this one also is from Double Indemnity. So just to set it up, Walter Neff, played by Fred McMurray, is an insurance salesman who goes to like a wealthy man's home to remind the man to renew his insurance. The maid lets him in. The man's not home. But Barbara Stanwyck appears at the top of the stairs in a bath towel. And that's it for Walter Neff. Like, he's done. So she puts on some clothes, comes downstairs, and then they talk. Barbara Stanwyck starts first.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head in your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it.
Oh, another hallmark of film noir is like great dialogue.
Yes, you can't do much better than that. And that's Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler working together to write that. That is a passage that is not in the book by James M. Cain, Double Indemnity. That one was just for the film. And it's a perfect example of what makes these films so special, because you can't really show anything, but you can certainly sling the double entendres as fast and furiously as you can.
You're right that Double Indemnity was the first time a Hollywood film explicitly explored the means, motives, and opportunity of committing murder. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. In the books that these films were based on were largely written in the 1930s and were part of a whole renaissance of hard-boiled crime writing that grew up in the pulp magazines and, you know, Dashiell Hammett and James M. Cain and Chandler and others. And the transition to the movie screen didn't really happen for another 10 years or so. And it was very difficult because of the production code to make movies in which the protagonists were the villains of the piece. And that's really what Double Indemnity did that kicked off the film noir movement. There were other films that you can call film noir before Double Indemnity, but its popularity and being nominated for Oscars and the fact that Barbara Stanwyck, who at that point was the highest paid woman in America, starred in this film, gave it this imprimatur, if you will, that it's okay now to do this kind of stuff. And Stanwyck was a bit afraid, honestly. She thought that, you know, she'd established herself as this great dramatic actress and a comedian, and that this film might kind of ruin her career, ruin her image. And Billy Wilder said, you know, oh, that's funny, I thought you were an actress. And that was all she had to hear. And she came right on board and gave it her all.
One of the things that Turner did recently was a series called Reframed, in which you and several other of the Turner hosts revisited some classic films and reexamined them, acknowledging how racism and sexism in the films make them problematic, but instead of canceling the films, creating a dialogue around them so we could still watch the films, appreciate what's good about them, and talk about what, like, is really not good. So what was that series like for you? And did it force you to, like, rethink things about certain films, or had you already gone through that process?
It was good. It was good, I think, for all the hosts to go through that. It was a very interesting exercise. I certainly got a lot out of it, because it's important to revisit these things and think of them in a slightly different way. I'm the oldest host at TCM, and so a lot of these films, you know, I grew up with. I mean, I remember seeing The Searchers when I was, you know, like 14 years old or something. And I certainly didn't see the things in it that I see in it now. And to me, that's completely fascinating. Like, yeah, the world changes. And if movies are going to remain a big part of the cultural discourse, we need to find a way to keep them relevant. So I was really excited about that series, and it certainly got a conversation going on social media.
One of the films I think you talked about was The Searchers. So what did you point out in that film that you hadn't noticed when you first saw it when you were, what, 14, did you say?
Yes. When you're 14 years old and it's 1974 or something when I saw that, or 1972 when I saw that movie, you know, it's a cowboy and Indians movie. And now you don't really want to say that, right? And a lot of people that I know loved that character of Ethan Edwards and have named their sons Ethan in honor of that character. And I think you really have to look twice and say, you know, it's a study of a character like that who has to overcome his ingrained racism, which is not really the way I think a lot of people saw that movie back in the day. I don't know that they thought that was the point of the movie. And now I watch the movie and I realize that, you know, the door closes on Ethan at the end of the movie and he's left out of the family unit because, you know, he's the mercenary that has to be used to accomplish the mission, but he doesn't get to be really part of the community at the end. That's a heavy concept, you know, and I don't know how many people were getting that, you know, back in the 60s and 70s.
How old were you when you started becoming really absorbed in film noir?
I think I was probably in my early teens.
Do you think you gravitated to these films because you already had a dark sensibility, or do you think you have a dark sensibility because of these films? I'm guessing you already had a dark sensibility.
I will say this about why I think I was drawn to that world. I do think it had a lot to do with my father, who was a wonderful, wonderful person. And I learned so much about his ability to navigate the treachery of the business he was in, because, you know, he was around boxing and he was around gangsters and all of this stuff. You know, I got a real insider's view of that, and he never let it color him as a person or especially as a father. He was a really kind, generous person. But I do believe I was drawn to the movies because they felt like his world. And I was born pretty late in his life. And, you know, I was a child of the 60s, and I was drawn to that 40s world. And I do believe it's because I never really saw my father in his prime. You know, he was a little past his prime when I was of age. And so it was really something to watch these movies and say, oh, that's the world that he thrived in. And that's exactly what it felt like to me.
Did you watch classic boxing noirs like The Harder They Fall or Body and Soul with your father?
It was very, very difficult because seeing as my father was a boxing expert, he mercilessly picked apart the boxing itself in the films. And as you know, in movies, everything has to be exaggerated for the effect so that people who do not really understand boxing to begin with feel the drama. You know, like in Raging Bull, any one of the punches thrown in Raging Bull would kill a normal human being. But there's just dozens and dozens of them, you know, and an avalanche of them in that film. And that would always bother my dad, who I remember seeing Raging Bull with him, and he literally out loud in the theater said, "For God's sake, stop the fight." And I'm thinking of these things, you know, my nascent cinephile being, you know, and I'm like thinking of how they told the story and why they did this or that. And then I'd hear my dad in the other room on the phone with some crony of his just complaining about how fraudulent the boxing scenes were. And, oh my God, Joe, you should have seen it. The first punch the guy threw would have killed him, you know, and it's like, oh my God.
Let's talk some more about film noir. Film noir flourishes after World War II. Why then? I mean, because after World War II, it's like the soldiers are home, the war is over, times, you know, the economy improves, things get better for a lot of people, not everybody. But why was that a time, do you think, that these classic, really dark films were made?
Because I think the artists were dealing with a lot of unfinished business. You have Hollywood pre-1934, which is when the production code was reinforced in Hollywood. And I'm sure you know all about pre-code movies and how they dealt with a lot of the themes that were sort of shelved until the film noir movement came around. And then in the Depression, Hollywood was sort of called upon to boost the nation's morale to get us through this hardship. And then immediately when the Depression ended, World War II began, and it was, again, Hollywood had to do its patriotic duty. Well, by the time World War II ended, one of the ironic spoils of winning that war was that artists were now free to tell the stories that they wanted to tell. And a lot of those stories were leftover things from what caused the Depression. Are we inherently avaricious and greedy? It was just a chance to let all this out finally, because they were no longer under any constraints. artists are also contrarians by nature. And if you tell them it has to have a happy ending, a certain percentage of the artists are going to say, no, I want it to end this way. This is my story, and I want to tell it this way. And I just think that's all of these factors came to bear. There were political factors, economic factors, artistic factors, cultural factors that all made noir happen right when it did. And I think that's really fascinating. And I always say that mid-century period from the end of World War II to sort of the middle of the 1950s was in many ways sort of where America lost its innocence. We tried to whitewash it in the 50s with all the TV sitcoms and everything, and everything's back to normal, but the genie had been let out of the bottle, so to speak. And film noir was a big part of that. And I think that's why it retains so much of its bite today, is because it reflects all of that. And whether people are completely conscious of it or not, I think that's what they're absorbing from the films.
You know, the production code, the Hays Code that you were referring to, is a code of morals that movies had to follow. I mean, married couples weren't even allowed to sleep in the same bed in movies. And you know, crime was not allowed to pay. Like, if you were a bad guy, you would be killed or sent to prison. It had to be punished. So how did film noir get around that? Like, give us one of your favorite examples.
It's interesting. They didn't always get around it, and it's a debate I often have with people where they say, well, that can't be film noir. It has a happy ending. And I say, well, the happy ending is less than 1 minute that was tacked on at the end of the film by the studio head. I'm kind of agreeing with what the artist was presenting in the previous 89 minutes, right? And you sometimes have these enforced endings. But, you know, a film that we were talking about on the show, Crisscross, certainly had a downer ending. It's Shakespearean, you know, and nobody lives at the end of that film. And it's interesting because when the villains are the protagonists and they get their comeuppance, that's completely okay by the code. The thing that's tricky is that the code can't adjudicate whether or not the audience is going to empathize with that villain. That's the real tricky part. And that's what made noir so special, right? I mean, you can't help yourself. This is especially true in heist movies, where they're committing a crime and they're not going to get away with it. They don't get away with it in the asphalt jungle. They don't get away with it in the killing. They never get away with it. But the audience is always rooting for them to get away with it, which is very much in defiance of the spirit of the code. But there's nothing you can do about it. In Double Indemnity, they're plotting a murder. And yet when they commit the crime and they're in the car and the car won't start and it seems like they're not going to get away, the whole audience is like, start, start. They want them to get away with it. And that's sort of, to me, the point of the whole noir movement, was that it allowed the audience to empathize with people who are doing the wrong thing. It's not encouraging the audience to do the wrong thing. It's just saying, here, you want to know what it's like when you cross that line? This is what happens.
Well, I'd like to close with some music, because the music is such a great part of film noir. Some of the scores are just terrific. And like Miklos Roja did some really great ones, including Double Indemnity. And this is a score I particularly like because it has that kind of, the drum is like a pounding heartbeat, like somewhere between a pounding, anxious heartbeat and a death march. And it's like the musical version of dread and doom. Do you want to say a few words about the music in film noir and its importance?
Well, I'm very glad that you're singling out Miklos Roja, because he is, to me, the best composer of noir. He, you know, Double Indemnity, The Killers, Crisscross, all they're fabulous scores. I think what's interesting about people's impressions of noir is a lot of people have developed a mistaken idea that the scores of these films are jazzy, that there's a lot of brass to them, which is actually something that didn't come in until the 1950s, and it was mostly on television and television theme songs, like Count Basie's theme for M Squad and, you know, the Henry Mancini's Peter Gunn theme and all that. But in the 40s, they were orchestral scores and very, very European influenced, you know, Max Steiner and Franz Waxman and Miklos Rozsa, as you say, and they're fabulous. I confess, I didn't appreciate them as much when I was younger as I do today. Having heard so much of it now, it's like music I'll just play.
Okay, so we're going to close with the music from the Miklos Rozsa score for Double Indemnity. And Eddie Miller, it's been so much fun to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for coming.
An absolute pleasure, Terry. Thank you so much for inviting me. And let's not wait another 25 years.
Absolutely. Eddie Muller's show, Noir Alley, is on Turner Classic Movies Saturday nights with a rebroadcast Sunday mornings. His book, Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir, was just published in a new expanded edition. The Sopranos is back with a new movie prequel called The Many Saints of Newark. The TV series ran on HBO from 1999 until its infamous finale in 2007. The movie is now showing in theaters and on HBO Max. The stars include Michael Gandolfini, the son of James Gandolfini, playing a teen version of Tony Soprano, the mob boss character his dad played in the original series. The film was directed by David Chase, who created The Sopranos. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Fans have waited a long time for another chapter in The Sopranos story. So long, in fact, that it's been 22 years since the series launched and changed TV history by putting a sinister character at the center of its ongoing story. And it's been 14 years since that unforgettable finale, when the narrative of Tony Soprano didn't so much end as it just stopped. The Many Saints of Newark gets around the finale problem by presenting a prequel set years before the events in The Sopranos took place. But it still has another problem, which is coming up with a movie-length drama that works both for people who remember the events and characters in The Sopranos and those who don't. And on that count, The Many Saints of Newark is a very mixed bag. It's a tricky balancing act. The best movie prequel to a TV drama series remains David Lynch's Twin Peaks film, Fire Walk With Me. The best prequel, period, is the Better Call Saul series offshoot from Breaking Bad, one of the many excellent shows to follow the path The Sopranos trailblazed. Vince Gilligan's brilliant TV drama showed a man getting more and more evil as the story progressed. This new Sopranos story does that too, following Tony as a youngster and a teen as the movie starts in 1967 and, halfway through, shifts in time to 1971. But it starts with an awkward and unsatisfying framing device, visiting a cemetery and having us listen to voices speaking to us from beyond the grave. One of them is the voice of Christopher Moltisanti, supplied by original Sopranos co-star Michael Imperioli.
I met death on Route 23, not too far from here. But that was much later. Back in 1967, the man wearing the hat was my father. In those days, he didn't have a son.
But
That man, Dickie Maltasanti, is played by Alessandro Nivola. Tony's uncle Dickie turns out to be the central character in this movie, but he's not one of the real standouts. In addition to Michael Gandolfini inheriting his father's role as Tony and doing it very well, the real standouts would include Ray Liotta, who brings equal intensity to two different tough guy roles, and Michaela De Rossi, who is fiery and formidable as Giuseppina, an Italian immigrant who figures in the lives of several men in this story. And my favorite, Vera Farmiga, who plays a younger version of Tony's abrasive mother Livia, and absolutely channels the spirit of Nancy Marchand, who originated the role in The Sopranos. Here she is as Livia, meeting with a school guidance counselor to discuss young Tony. Talia Balsam plays the counselor.
On the basis of the Sanford Binet, he's high IQ. You know that.
You can't prove it by me. He's got a D plus average.
Well, that's because he doesn't apply himself, but he is smart.
There's a big difference between a smart person and a smart aleck.
I also administered the Briggs-Meyer personality inventory just now, and the results tell us. He's a leader. Enthusiastic, insightful, playful.
Ah, you're talking through your hat.
Tony as a teen is played by Michael Gandolfini. And a bit later, mother and son get to share a scene in which both players get to sound and act uncannily like the actors who preceded them in their roles. We even get to hear Livia's unforgettable trademark phrase.
You smoking marijuana, I suppose?
Mom, I'm on the team.
Your sister is. I'm almost sure of it.
This hamburger's great, Mom.
Go on. I went to all that trouble just so we could have a nice conversation for once. And for what? How am I supposed to enjoy a Broadway show with my children and their pot?
Ma, I don't smoke pot.
Well, your sister comes in here smelling like a gypsy.
Well, I'm not my sister. I'm always being accused.
Oh, poor you.
But that famous catchphrase is caught only by those fans who remember it. The real joy of The Many Saints of Newark is seeing glimpses of Sopranos characters as they pop up. There's Polly Walnuts, and Tony's sister Janice, and Carmella. But all of those characters are underused. What's worse, what happens in this movie prequel has no real sense of clarity. It's a confusing narrative, and it's not at all easy to keep track of the relationships among the characters. One of the things that made The Sopranos such a superb dramatic series was its subtlety. Characters rarely, if ever, said what they really thought, even in therapy. In this new movie, intentions and motivations are revealed, often overtly. Sopranos creator David Chase, who wrote the script with Lawrence Connor, seems to have no problem embracing this more obvious approach, which is unfortunate. Director Alan Taylor is good with his cast. The performances are the best aspect of The Many Saints of Newark. But his visual flair tends to show itself only when there's a dead body to focus on, which, in this Sopranos prequel, is often. This new drama shows, over time, how Tony Soprano broke bad. Just not with the same flair and grace notes we've come to expect from The Sopranos.
David Bianculli is a professor of TV studies at Rowan University. He reviewed The Many Saints of Newark, The Sopranos movie prequel. Fresh Air's Dave Davies has the next interview. Here's Dave.
Our guest is actor, writer, and director Stanley Tucci. He's appeared in more than 70 films, including Big Night, Julie and Julia, The Lovely Bones, The Devil Wears Prada, as well as countless TV and stage productions. But lately, it seems Tucci has been thinking more about food than acting. He's published two cookbooks, and he recently hosted a six-part series on CNN called Stanley Tucci Searching for Italy. In each episode, he chooses a region in the land of his ancestors and talks to people who create and serve amazing food, and in some cases, those who raise the crops and livestock they come from. In the Bologna episode, he talks about the origins of Parmesan cheese and is treated to the opening of a huge wheel of the best.
Milk is king in Emilia-Romagna. The white cows are the Bianca Modenese breed, unique to the valley of the River Po that runs through this region.
Bravo, bravo.
Emilia Romagna's medieval monks, hungry for a long-lasting cheese.
It's like a magic act.
Yeah. Invented Parmigiano. Thank God for them.
Three,
two, one,
open!
Oh, my God.
Smell, smell, smell. This is, the smelling is unbelievable.
Oh, my
the
God.
Smell is unbelievable.
Oh, my God.
Mamma mia.
There's plenty of that kind of enthusiasm for food in the series and in Stanley Tucci's new book. It's a memoir not about his performing career, but about his experiences with and love for great food, starting with the cooking of his parents and grandparents, who not only served great dinners, but packed his lunchbox with offerings unique and delicious. The book also describes Tucci's battle with an illness that took away his sense of taste and smell, and for a long stretch made it impossible to eat solid food at all. He's back to cooking and eating, we're happy to say, and he joins us to talk about his book, Taste, My Life Through Food. Stanley Tucci, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You know, having read this book, I think I want to relive your childhood just for the food. Tell us a little about your parents, where you grew up.
Well, I grew up in Westchester County, Catona, New York, about 50 miles north of the city. And my parents are both Italian-American, and their parents had come from Italy. And they were all great cooks. And so I grew up with really, really amazing food, but not only just the food, but it was also the sort of enthusiasm for food and the interest in food. Everything revolved around what you were going to eat that night, what you were eating for lunch, what you, so it couldn't help but become a huge part of who I am. And as you mentioned in the introduction, when I would go to school, you know, I went to the local school, I brought, you know, you'd bring your lunch. I never bought lunch. Maybe I bought lunch twice in, you know, 12 years. But I would bring whatever was left over from dinner the night before, usually in some other form. So if we had veal cutlets or chicken cutlets, I would have those on a sandwich. If we had eggplant parmigiana, that was also incorporated into a sandwich. Things like that, and I would bring a full, like a bag, like a grocery bag, was my lunch as I got older because there was so much food in it.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite descriptions, recipes, if you will, in the book is the description of your grandfather's making of tomato paste, which he would store in soda bottles down in the basement. You want to just give us how this worked?
Yeah, so it's not a paste. Okay, so basically, sauce. It's like a passata. In a sense. So a passata is where you don't have any of the skin or the seeds, right? So what you're doing is you're getting all, some of the tomatoes came from the garden, but some of them they would buy. And they would take them, as far as I can remember, and they would take them and you put them into pillowcases. And then you have like big galvanized, you know, tins, drums, right? And you would squeeze them, all the tomatoes, through the pillowcase, and what came out is this beautiful, beautiful red juice. Then you had soda bottles, probably that were probably from the 1930s, I swear, and they were, you'd fill them up with this juice and put in a bay leaf and a little bit of salt, and then you would cap it. They had a capper, you know, and then because you could buy the caps, and they used the same bottles every year. And then you would take that and you'd boil it to pasteurize it. Or is that what it is? Pasteurizing, I guess? Yeah.
Right. And you end up with these pillowcases that look like relics of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Yes, exactly, as I wrote in the book, yes.
Right. In your descriptions of a lot of these recipes and your family's practices, there's a little bit of a hard edge here about what you do and don't do with Italian cooking. Like one of the things you hate is seeing just any pasta paired with any sauce, that there has to be, you know, you got to have the right kind of pasta. Like what's an example of a bad coupling of pasta?
Well, you wouldn't put like a bolognese with star pasta. okay? That's just weird and gross. It'd just be mush. So you need something formidable that's going to stand up to that, to that sauce, the sort of richness of that sauce. And you would use, in Bologna, they'll use like a homemade tagliatelle. They might use pappardelle. But certainly you're also going to use that in, you're going to use lasagna and make a lasagna with it. So those are, they're good, strong pastas. Not quite as strong as a dried pasta, right? Because they're fresh pasta. But to serve, even with a bolognese, you'd serve like, maybe you would do it with, or you could have it maybe with the rigatoni or something like that. But so, I mean, and this is the way it is in Italy. It's one of the reasons I wanted to make the TV show about, you know, regional cuisine, is because, yes, it's regional, but it's also, but it's also each person is incredibly specific about about what they're going to make, and then what pasta goes with it or what sauce goes with. I mean, that's the way Italy is. That sort of very specific, almost dogmatic way of thinking regarding food is what I was brought up with.
You wrote that bread was not eaten with pasta.
Never. No, it couldn't. You just couldn't do it. I mean, you just wouldn't do it. And butter was never put on the table, right? So butter was only put on the table when we had meatballs that were fried on a Friday night. But they were fried. There was no sauce. They were just fried in olive oil. And they were absolutely delicious. And you'd have those with bread and butter. It was a really nice combination. And then you'd have a green salad afterwards. And that was your meal.
You know, you write that your father would often cook on Friday nights to give your mom a break. And by then, like, the budget was stretched a little thin. Sometimes those were a little spare. And one of the first recipes in the book is a very simple dish of your father cooking pasta with garlic and oil. It, really tasty. But the last instruction on the recipe is, cheese is not allowed.
Mm.
Now, why would this be? A lot of people would love to grate some Parmesan on that.
Yeah, you would, but it changes the flavor profile of the entire dish. It becomes a completely different dish. Maybe not in a bad way, but you'd want something more to help it. You would want to add some of the pasta water in and toss it up with the cheese in the pan. Do you know what I mean? So, because otherwise it would just be claggy and kind of not good. But what you really want is that kind of strange freshness that you're getting from the little sprinkle of paprika if you use it, and just the utter simplicity of garlic, oil, and salt. It couldn't be simpler.
And you never cut your spaghetti. This drives you crazy when you see a grown person cutting spaghetti on a plate.
Yeah, that's
right?
Just, what is that? That's just ridiculous. I don't even understand that, you know.
Well, I think it's because it's so awkward sometimes to have a big string of pasta hanging from your mouth, so it's to avoid embarrassment or spills, maybe.
Yeah, but it's more embarrassing to cut your pasta.
I wanted to talk about the illness that you suffered, because it definitely had to do with your ability to enjoy food. You know, your first wife, Catherine, died in 2009 from breast cancer, and you married Felicity Blunt, who happens to be the sister of Emily Blunt. And you write in the book about how with both you had a lot of mutual interest in great food. It's really a through line in your life. So you have this wonderful set of relationships with food. And then a few years ago, you end up being diagnosed with a kind of oral cancer. It began in the saliva gland, is that right?
No, it began, no, it never was in the saliva gland, but my saliva was severely compromised, basically, for all practical purposes, disappeared during the treatments and for a long time afterward. I still don't have all of my saliva back. It was at the base of my tongue, but it manifested itself. The pain was a referred pain up in my jaw, the back of my jaw. So, you know, they thought it was a tooth. They thought it was trigeminal neuralgia. They thought it was a million different things, except what it was, which was cancer. And so I was misdiagnosed for 2 years. I did acupuncture. I tried a whole bunch of different things and nothing worked. And finally, the tumor became so large that it was quite visible to this one doctor here, who happened to be a salivary gland guy. So he looked, he goes, look, this is what you have. This is what you're going to do. And I was horrified. I was terrified. Luckily, it had not metastasized, and that was a really obviously good thing. But the treatment was brutal, brutal. And after 3 years, you know, I'm cancer-free, but after 3 years, you know, I'm still not back to normal because there was an extremely high dose of radiation they had to give me.
It was heavy radiation and chemotherapy. And while this is happening, what happened to your sense of taste and smell? And
disappeared. I can't say it disappeared. It didn't disappear. I wish it had. What happened was everything tasted like you know what, and everything smelled like that too. And that went on for months and months and months and months. My mouth was so compromised, you know, it becomes just completely ulcerous. I had to have a feeding tube for 6 months. I couldn't even drink during the treatment and even a bit afterward. I couldn't even drink water because it burned my mouth so much. And still to this day, I can't really eat spicy things at all. Only recently have I been able to drink carbonated water because carbonation really just, it's so hypersensitive, your mouth. It was horrible. I was basically bedridden for 6 months.
Right. And you had small children. Your daughter Camilla was actually born.
She was born in the same hospital where I was getting treatment in New York. And it was at Mount Sinai, and these doctors were absolutely incredible. I feel very, very lucky to have found these doctors, and one of whom has become a friend of ours. And I just feel so, so lucky that I had them and that they were able to heal me.
You lost a lot of weight and some hair.
I lost my facial hair. But that's grown back for the most part. Not fully down on the neck. But yeah, there was one day it just all fell out. And then one day when I woke up, about, I don't know how many months later, 8 months later or more, even more, I looked and it was all blue underneath my nose. My upper lip was all blue. And I was like, what is that? And then I realized my hair had grown back. My mustache had grown back. Oh. Like literally overnight. It was weird.
Yeah.
And my daughter said, Dad, what do you have under your nose? I said, it's my hair. It's coming back. And then the rest of it slowly came back.
Oh, man. The other odd thing about it is that the effect that it had on your metabolism and the food allergies you'd had. What happened?
Well, it increased my metabolism. I already had a fast metabolism, but it increased it. So I was down to about 134 pounds or something like that. And I think I had weighed about 165, 67 or something when I went, which actually was a bit too heavy for a person my height and age. So it took a long time for me to gain the weight back. So I'm about like at 153 pounds now, which is fine with me. But it's taken 3 years to do that. And any allergies I had to dairy or to wheat or to like bananas disappeared, completely disappeared.
Wow. It's like you rebooted.
I rebooted. Reboot. You know, it's like they say, you know, when you go to gastroenterologist, they'll cut out, you know, or a dietitian, they'll cut foods out of your diet to see if you have an allergic reaction, to see what you're allergic to, and then you slowly reintroduce them.
Wow. So now, you said that you can't eat spicy food. You don't have quite your normal amount of saliva. But does food taste like it should? Can you enjoy the spaghetti with zucchini?
Absolutely, food tastes yes, like it should. Except sometimes fruit tastes odd. I don't know why, but so that's odd. but everything else, no taste. In fact, it's almost heightened now. So I can smell things that I couldn't even, that I never would have been able to smell before. And I can taste things much more quickly. Like I'm much hyper aware of what things taste like now.
You know, you're right that you chose to tell the story of the illness in the book in part because the experience taught you how important food was to you, and not just as sustenance or, you know, sensual pleasure, but that a comfort, a challenge, and a way of connecting with people you love, including generations that have gone before. You know, when you eat these meals of your ancestors and when your parents are gone, people will know them in some way through that. And this struck me as a lovely insight, and it also struck me as it kind of reminds me of the comforts and connections that many people get from religion and religious ritual to connect to generations and people through it.
Yeah, it is. I suppose it is a kind of religion for me. I'm not a religious person, but if there is one thing that's holy, it would be food.
Well, Stanley Tucci, it has been fun. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's been really great. Thanks.
Stanley Tucci's new book is called Taste, My Life Through Food. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Buonasera, signorina, buonasera. It is time to say goodnight to Napoli. Though it's hard for us to whisper, buonasera, with that old moon above the Mediterranean Sea.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.